Simone, Stefan, Simona, Renault, and Philippe. They're still on the living room floor asleep. Flight was delayed, but they got it so cheap in Amsterdam. The cat jumped off of the fire escape. He's a little shook up, but he don't have a scrape. Climb up to the roof, let's make a crepe. You bring the jam. This is the life of Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo. This is the life of Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo. This is the life of Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo. Bohemia. Showers in the kitchen, there might be some soap. Dishes in the sink, brush your teeth if you can cope. Toilets in the closet, you better hope there's a light bulb in there. Ba-ba-ba. Dino called yesterday, the rent is overdue. Con Ed and New York telephone are mad too. Better screen the calls for a day or two. Or cough up your share, yeah. This is the life, bo-bo-bo-bo. This is the life, bo-bo-bo-bo.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos. This week on Broadway for Sunday, October 30th, 2016. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast today, we have Michael Portantier and Genesessa Fox. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications, like Fox News. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Also with us is Genesessa Fox. Jenna is a theater writer and reviewer whose articles have appeared online in timeoutnewyork.com, playbill.com, broadwayworld.com, and newyorktheaterguide.com. She has interviewed Jennifer Ashley Tepper four times, and the fifth interview will be on howlround.com early next year. Good morning, Jenna.
Good morning.
All right. With us today, we have someone who totally needs no introduction because we talk about her so often on this program that everybody knows Jennifer Ashley Tepper, who is a historian, is a producer, is a Broadway fan of enormous, enormous superhero proportions. Thank you for getting up on a Sunday morning. Sunday morning, the no man's land of Broadway. Jen, thank you so much.
I'm so happy to chat. It's always great fun when we get to do this.
Well, we're really excited to get you back on, and we really the impetus of your third volume of your novel, the Untold Stories of Broadway, which is not a novel. It's actually fact.
I'm super excited that the book is finally coming out November 15th. So, it's basically each book has eight different theaters. So this book has eight new theaters I haven't explored yet. And I think that they're really just some good ones to find out some stories about. So I'm really excited for people to read it.
So eight times three is 24. And
yeah, well, there's also one of the theaters in each book is like a lost theater that's been demolished or is no longer. So technically, I got to do like six volumes to get to all 41.
And, what is I hate to ask you what your favorite story from the volume three is, but tell us a story that maybe people would be most surprised to read about.
There's a few that I can like quickly pinpoint that I'm psyched for people to read. Jerry Adler, who's the third oldest working actor in Actors Equity, who's an amazing guy who's had 50 Broadway credits on doing all kinds of different things, stage managing, producing, acting. He gave me some insanely incredible stories about stage managing the original My Fair Lady, including one time when as stage manager, he had to deliver an audience member's baby in a box seat. So he kind of has like the highlights of what it was like to be, a stage manager in the crazy 1950s Broadway sphere. I was really excited. I got a story from Hal Prince that, being his hugest fan, I hadn't read this story anywhere else. And it's a really funny, story about him being an assistant stage manager and having to go on for a role. So that's another highlight. But there's a lot of, I think with the third book, one of the main things I really wanted to do was interview as many additional people, because I interviewed like 25 additional interviewees for each volume. I really wanted to get to as, people over the age of 80. Like I kept saying, I'm only interviewing octogenarians this time. So that each chapter of the book starts as far back chronologically as possible and gives you as full a story about that theater as possible. So a lot of, I think, my favorite stories in the third book happen to be, you know, older theater professionals, which is really cool.
I was about to ask if you've done the Hellinger yet, but I think you just answered that question with what you said about My Fair Lady.
Oh, you know, actually, his My Fair Lady stories are the Hellinger was in book one. It was the first Lost theater I did. But his Hellinger, I mean, his My Fair Lady stories are from the Broadhurst.
Oh,
that was what you're talking about. Yeah.
All right. So yes to both. Yes.
And one of my, I just knew a couple pages into this, even before we got to the stories, that I was going to love this book because you dedicated it to the makers of Shuffle Along 1921 and 2016. Did you get a chance to talk to anybody from the 21 or do some research on the 21 Shuffle Along?
You know, I haven't done the original Shuffle Along, of course, was at a theater that unfortunately will never be featured in the book because it closed too long ago for me to talk to anyone that was living that worked in it, which is, you know, such a sad thing and why I love to dig back as far as possible. But I haven't actually done the music box yet. And when I do the music box, I will dig deep into that Shuffle Along history because I think that show will be an important part of it. But, you know, that show really inspired a lot of, you know, I kept thinking like, oh, I know everything there is to know about being a theater historian. And obviously, you know, I'm not perfect at it now. I'll get better as I age. But I felt like when I saw that musical, I didn't know everything yet about being a theater historian. And it taught me so much. So that was part of the reason for the dedication. And even though Shuffle Along isn't, well, there's actually, you know, one of my other endeavors with the third book was to kind of include a lot of stories about women in theater and about artists of color that, you know, might not have made it into the history books otherwise, but of shows that happened that involved those people. So there's a little bit of, you get to hear about a couple shows that Shuffle Along factors into, but also it was really cool to, I have a couple interview, you know, stories with George C. Wolfe, who of course was such an important part of what happened on Broadway with that. And he, Angels in America, is in this next book because the Walter Kerr is in it. So in a way, there's that part of Shuffle Along as well. You get a big George C. Wolfe kind of story about his aesthetic and his, you know, artistry as director of that show.
Have you ever thought about making a live show component to the book where people tell these stories?
Definitely. Yeah, you know, we've actually done a similar thing. We've done these evenings in honor of specific theaters at 54 Below. And what's interesting, we did one for the Colonial when it was in danger, which was really great and celebratory and ended up, you know, making a huge noise, which was great. And then we did one for the Neil Simon as well. And they really are like kind of like live versions of it. But I think in order to do a real live version of it, I would want to incorporate like the exact people that are in the chapter reading their exact stories. And that kind of thing hasn't timed out exactly. But we have done these celebrations that have been really great and hope to do more about specific theaters.
When the construction over at Toys R Us in Times Square was happening and they unearthed remnants of an old theater there, did you throw on a construction hat and run over there?
Absolutely did. I like saw it right immediately, like that day. That was really exciting. And I think one of the most exciting things about that to me, because really that theater, I mean, that's been gone for a very long time. There was no like, oh, they found this, we're going to restore it. Like it was a little piece of an orchestra pit, but that there were so many people so excited about what that was and like just like learning about it. Like that's always inspiring to me when people actually care about the history of it. And, the Edison is in that the Edison is the Loft Theater in book three. And the Edison is still there. So I persist in thinking that all these like the Hellinger theaters that are no longer Broadway, but that are still standing really could, you know, come back into the in the, our future, especially because of the health of the, you know, theater real estate market. So that's kind of anytime people are interested in knowing stuff like that is exciting to me.
On a somewhat related note, have you heard anything lately as to whether the apparently idiotic plan to raise RAISE, the Palace Theater, is still in place? Because I haven't heard anything about it in a while, and they keep announcing new shows for the Palace. So I was just wondering if you had any more information than I do.
Yeah, you know, I don't. I think that it definitely is still in the works, but maybe they're playing with the timing because of all the other construction going on around that area. I'm pretty sure, I mean, I heard something about how they can't do it while there's this construction right across the street, like right across 47th, but I don't know if that's true. But I think, I mean, I hate it and I wish it wasn't happening, but I really do look at it on the other hand of like all of the Broadway theaters that exist today that we wouldn't have if they hadn't had those compromises made, like with the Broadway having the giant office building built on top of it. I think that, you know, obviously with the real estate market again being what it is, like if we want to keep the theaters, we can't be totally, you know, uncompromising with stuff like that. So I wish none of it happened, but in any case, I'm just glad we get to keep the theater.
Right.
Many, many years ago, my brother was a real estate appraiser and was asked to do an appraisal of the air rights over the Winter Garden. And the Winter Garden sits there as a big right above it, big void above it. And I'm surprised that there's never been a big office building there in the Winter Garden as well. Do you ever think that that could be a potential future office building that they're going to have to make a compromise at the Winter Garden as well?
You know, I have noticed that as well. Like, I'll be looking at the Winter Garden because it's so gorgeous and notice that you really do have, like, a full view of the sky above it, which is kind of crazy. I feel like if the Schuberts sold the air rights above the Winter Garden, they might not, you know, the building might not be above the Winter Garden, so to speak. But I feel like that's, like, a prize crown jewel to them. And I feel like similar to, I don't think they would let anything be built above the Schubert. I think that there's some kinds of, like, pride regarding the actual buildings that somewhat exists, but who knows, you know, like things change and 10 years could go by and that could be different. But some part of me can't picture an office building above the Winter Garden, thankfully, but you know, we'll listen to this in 20 years when it's happening and we'll laugh about how we were wrong.
Well, as you both sort of indicated, and I'm no expert on air rights, but they don't have to necessarily be sold for the actual space. It can be sold someone to build something across the street. So do we know otherwise? They may have already sold them some time ago. And then there may be a tower, you know, on the back or on the other side of 7th Avenue that's there because of that. I mean, I really don't know. But to me, I guess that stuff doesn't bother me so much. Raising a theater is in a different category for me. So
totally.
I hope that we'll just hope for the best with that.
Any plans for the Hudson Theater? And what have you heard about that?
The Hudson is, I mean, this is like the most exciting thing in the entire world that we're getting a new Broadway theater this season. And I do persist in, you know, hearing that it's opening this season, even though the production of Burn This was postponed. But what was interesting was the Lyric is actually in book 3. So I spent a lot of time interviewing house staff at the Lyric who, you know, because the Lyric and the Hudson are both controlled by Ambassador Theater Group. They're very connected. And there's people that, you know, are going from working at the Lyric to working at the Hudson. And I had been in there before for like galas, like the classic stage concert gala and things like that. And it really does look like a Broadway theater already. But I take it that they had to kind of do a renovation involving, you know, a lot of making the backstage fit for Broadway, you know, performers today. And I'm sure, you know, the orchestra pit and you can kind of walk by and hear them literally outside the, you know, Hudson and the Millennium Hotel, you can hear the construction. So all I've heard is that, you know, they're committed to making it as beautiful as it was in its like heyday, and that there's a lot that had to be done to get, you know, the facilities up to date, but that the actual, you know, the shape of it is a Broadway theater already. So I'm really excited to see it. And you can kind of also peek in, you know, on the 45th Street side. If you peek in, you can often see them working on it, which is very cool.
Yeah, I've been to several events there, too, and it seems like from the audience standpoint, basically what they just need to do is put back orchestra seats. And I have been actually back in the wings, and it seems to me the wings are fairly large for a theater of that size. So maybe they have a lot to work with to begin with, and it doesn't have to be this major huge renovation. And on a similar note, did you all see, I guess it must have happened now, that they had some kind of an open house at the Hellinger, the church that's there now.
No.
Yes, they had some Yeah, they had. I mean, actually, you can. You can go in anytime. I have done on more than one occasion with some friends when we've been walking by. They're very welcoming to let people just come in and look. But they also had a specific day recently. I think it happened already where they invited people to come in and see the theater. So that's nice.
That's exciting. I mean, I keep hearing that the church is willing to move as long as they can find a bigger space. So, you know, some theater organization is going to snatch that up. I really do believe that and hope for it.
Yeah, we've been hoping for that for a while. Apparently, they've outgrown it in the sense that they have to have their services shown on closed circuit TV to remote locations. So it's really not it's not even big enough for the congregation. One would think of let's think of a place where they can move.
The theater at Madison Square Garden.
Well, that would be great.
Take it. Oh.
Because I've never seen anything good there.
And also, it's
that can work.
Yeah. So back to your book. For this volume 3, you interviewed over 250 theater professionals, and you go on to list different professions like actors, directors, writers, producers, designers, stagehands, musicians, box office treasurers, house managers, doormen and women, advertising executives, company managers, press agents, stage managers, ushers, and so many more. I'm tired. Just your schedule is so demanding. How are you fitting all this in? Are you and especially you just mentioned you're working on the next one. So how are you finding these people? Is it all through somebody says, you should go talk to so and so about this great story, or is it just that you're cold calling people and saying, hey, tell me what you know?
You know, the first thing is that so the first book came out in 2013, and I spent all of 2013 like a maniac interviewing people. But the interviews are kind of, they've stacked up. So I interviewed like 200 people for that first volume in 2013, which was great fun, and which was, I think that, you know, interviewing the people was such a big part of what the book became, because I would go, okay, it's Saturday, I can fit in an interview at 10 a.m., noon, 2 p.m., 4 p.m., yeah. 6 p.m., and then mm-hmm. they'd be in all different parts of New York, and it would be kind of like this crazy adventure, and all the stories would end up having like parallels and like fun things that connected them because I was doing them in one day. So that was like an adventure. And then for volume 2, which came out in 2014, and then for this one, I've added like 25 additional interviews each time, but it's still, you know, like I interviewed whoever, you know, Hal Prince in 2013, but I'm not using his story about the Broadhurst until now. So it was kind of like collecting all those stories and then saving them for the specific theaters that I was talking about in each book. So that in that way, you know, I've done 25 interviews in the last year, which isn't nothing, but, you know, it's manageable. And that kind of, you know, there's 25 new interviewees that have never appeared in another volume before. So that's kind of how that has worked. But as far as deciding who to interview and, you know, chasing down people of different professions, it really, at first, it was very much like, these are all interesting people that I know who they are. And, you know, I want to interview them. And a lot of it during the first volume was specific interviews leading the other interviews. Like I remember talking to Lin-Manuel Miranda and he said, oh, we're talking about the Rogers. You have to interview Tim Petalina. He's the house manager there and he's been there for a million years and he's worked for the Nederlanders since college and he like runs that house. And so I interviewed Tim who ended up being kind of like the narrator of that chapter. And this was obviously purely because of the hype at the time, just because of Lynn. And then people that are on house staff, like in that regard, were often recommended to me by people who had worked there. Like another funny one was like Christian Borle and Annal Nathan and all these other people all said, if you're doing the marquee, you have to talk to Ray Concepcion, who's the doorman. He's been there since the theater opened and he's really like the king of the house there and everyone loves him. He's a great guy. So a lot of those house interviews were kind of pointed out to me by, you know, people who work in the theater, but I mean like actors who I knew already. But in the second and third books, a big part of it has been kind of filling in the blanks. So I'll go, oh, I'm doing the St. James. I don't have anyone who worked there from, you know, 65 to 70. And I also could really use another stagehand from this house. and it would be really nice if it was a woman. And then you go, oh my God, I'm searching like crazy. Where's the woman who worked at the St. James in 66 and was a stagehand? And you can't find that person. So you, you know, fill in the blank in another way. So it's really been like a puzzle for the second and third books. And the first book was just like throwing paint at the wall and seeing what kind of art it made.
When you were in high school, 1,238.6 miles away from New York City.
I'm glad I included that so we can all.
And I'm, how are you measuring it from your front door to Staten Island or from your front door to Midtown Manhattan or, you know, anyway,
I think I literally did my door to the Neil Simon Theater, if you want to know, but
okay.
Yeah.
And is it as the crow flies or driving directions? So, so when you're in high school down in Florida and, you think to yourself, I want to do what? What were you thinking at that point? And how is it that, how has it been developing your own entire job that never existed before you ever got that job?
That's a great question. I was very inspired growing up by like a number of theater professionals that I felt like didn't really fit into a box. And, you know, the ones I think about most often are Ted Chapin and Ira Weitzman and even Ken Mandelbaum, who I devoured his books growing up. And these were people who I knew kind of occupied a unique place in the theater community. So I persisted in thinking that like I wanted to work in producing and I wanted to be a theater historian, but that I wanted to write and I wanted to do all kinds of things, but that there might be a way to do those things that wasn't like, you know, I want to be a producer. I want to be a writer. Like it kind of occurred to me that I might be able to carve out my own path in that way. And certainly, you know, I personally had a lot of years of figuring that out and trying to, you know, do all kinds of different jobs to develop skills that would help me in forging that path. But those people really inspired me and gave me a lot of hope that there were kind of unique things you can do in theater that weren't, you know, again, in a box.
And then we get to things like, I have to ask you a question about the best worst thing that could have ever happened, which is a documentary about the way we roll along. I mean, how could you even, when was the first time you heard that they were making this documentary and did you jump out of your skin?
You know, what's funny was I believe I'm remembering this correctly and I'll have to really check this because it, you know, but when I was in college or maybe right after, no, when I was in college, the company screening happened with the like Raul Esparza company being filmed for TV and Lonnie directed it. And I went to a screening of it. And at the screening, Lonnie said, and I'm working on this Merrily We Roll Along documentary. And this was like 8 years ago. And I immediately said to him, oh my God, if you need any help with it, if you need anything, if you need a research, you know, assistant, anything. And he, and I mean, I think I followed up with an email the next week and he immediately emailed me back and he said, oh my God, we're looking for this lost footage that was at ABC that they filmed behind the scenes in 1981. And we need to do a couple things to try to see if it might be in these few places. And can you help with that? And of course I said, yes, you know, nothing would be more exciting to me. It's my favorite musical. And just even being around Lonnie was really exciting. And so I worked a little bit on trying to help find some of that lost footage and then organizing some of the things that we did find. So that was, you know, it was almost a decade ago. And I was really lucky in that Lonnie kind of kept me, you know, abreast of all the developments with the documentary. And I keep in touch with a lot of the original cast. So I knew when they were being interviewed and what was going on with it. So I've kind of been there every step of the way to see this thing come to life. And it's amazing to me that theater people work on something for so long, not knowing if anyone's going to see it. And it happens and it just feels like a miracle. And the documentary is incredible. And one of my favorite things is that people who have been seeing it, who like Merrily, but are not obsessed with it, it's not their number one favorite musical like it is for me, have said, this is just an amazing documentary. It's my favorite theater documentary. You know, I'm not obsessed with Merrily. I like it. But like this documentary really makes me understand it. And that kind of stuff, it's really exciting that that's out there in the world.
Well, I've always thought that the story of the show itself is so fascinating and really kind of initially heartbreaking and then it kind of inspiring in the end after decades into what it became. And so regardless of how you feel about the show itself, whether it's your number one favorite or not, it's so fascinating, and I can't wait to see that movie.
Yeah.
So one of the theaters you focus on here is one of my favorites, the St. James Theater, where I've seen mm-hmm. so many amazing shows. And as we go through and read the different stories from all the different shows going back forever, it seems, I wonder to myself, did you have any inclination to add Birdman into the history here?
Yeah, you know, I didn't do an interview about it, but it is, there's some stuff about Birdman, and there's a lot of people that talk about the staircase at the back of the orchestra section during various shows over, you know, the whole course of the history. And then, you know, people talk about seeing Birdman and seeing St. James on screen and how it just brings back those memories working on shows there. So, and I kind of give some background for, you know, Birdman filming there. So those kinds of things sneak in for any of the Broadway theaters that have had like scenes from major movies filmed there. I try to mention that because it's an important part of how you can like actually view the theater and its history. So yeah, the St. James chapter though, that's one of the good ones where I feel like I was really able to go back, you know, pretty far in time. The St. James chapter at the beginning, there's like a story from Joan Shepherd, who was in Sunny River, the last musical Oscar Hammerstein wrote before he started collaborating with Richard Rodgers and wrote Oklahoma, which of course also was at the St. James. And I have George S. Irving, you know, telling some stories about that. So Joan Shepherd literally is talking about a time that, I mean, when she talks about auditioning for Oscar Hammerstein, and she was a kid in the show, so she couldn't sing or dance. She could only act because there was the Gerry Society, which prevented kids from being involved with vice, which included singing and dancing. And she talks about all of this happening in the St. James. Yeah, and it just feels like a completely another time. And what's so weird is that all of us who follow theater history, you know, we know about Oklahoma, and when George F. Irving tells those stories, you're like, how incredible that he was there, but it's not something foreign to us. But then you get a little farther back from that, and you're like, this happened, and there's someone who is living right now who experienced it. So the St. James, I feel good about how, you know, how far back I got history-wise.
Jen, for Ashley Tepper, what is next up for you outside of writing Volume 4?
You know, we have so much exciting stuff coming up at 54 Below. And there's a few things that I'll be, you know, hands-on producing, including one obscure musical in concert that is a Broadway show that has not been seen since it closed on Broadway very abruptly. So that's all I can say, but it's the first time it's ever being performed since then, which is super exciting. Yeah, you know, 54 Below, we do so many shows a week that, you know, there's so much good stuff going on, but there's always a lot that I get to like put my personal stamp on. And there's a few more of those coming up to look out for. So that's exciting. And then, you know, I hope to start on book four sooner rather than later. Cause you know, there's so many, as I've been writing these, you realize that like when people are gone, their stories are just gone with them. And there's so many people I want to get to and talk to about this topic before, you know, so that we can have their stories. So that's coming up at some point.
Well, fortunately, I'm sorry. Go on.
Jen?
I'm sorry. I was going to ask Jennifer, what is the most meaningful story that you've heard so far, and what has meant the most to you personally?
That's a great question. You know, there've been a lot. There's a few stories that are in this just because, you know, I've been so deep into this third book that it's what's on my mind, but there's a few stories in it that are just about how just like persevering people in the theater are. And those always really are, you know, inspiring to me and touching. But there's an usher named Sylvia Bailey who has a story in this book, and she's in her 90s and she's an usher at Phantom, and she's ushered there since it opened. And, you know, she kind of got the job as like she literally was like a dancer in New York in the 40s and has had this fascinating life. And she kind of got that job as like a survival job, but it's like, you know, she's kind of the light of the Majestic, so to speak. And she's amazing. And her story, things like that, that you go, you know, one of the most inspiring writers to me, of course, when being inspired to write this, is Studs Terkel. And sometimes I get into this territory that's a little bit less of like, let me tell you trivia about you know, Thoroughly Modern Millie, and a little bit more, like, let me tell you about my life and how I ended up being an usher at Phantom when I'm, you know, 92 years old. And that's always kind of, you take a step back and you go, oh my God, this is not just people's professions, it's people's lives. And so that story is really like, woe to me. And then, Peter Gallagher has a couple of like doozies in this book. He was one of the new interviewees for volume 3 that's not actually over the age of 80. And he's just like, I interviewed him for like an hour and every story he told was kind of like jaw dropping. Like, he's just a fantastic storyteller. But one of the stories that he tells in this next book is about how he was working in the theater and, you know, all of that. And then he left for Hollywood for a couple of years. And then when he came back, you know, almost everyone he had worked with, he felt like was gone. And it was like the, you know, AIDS epidemic, and just like how he experienced that. And he talks about how he had a friend that was really sick and that he took care of, who was HIV positive, who they couldn't afford the medicine and they couldn't afford the doctor's appointments. But Peter was in the real thing. So he literally bartered real thing house seats to get care and treatment and medicine for his friend. And it's like those insanely, like those human stories that, and I don't, you know, I haven't read that in any other, you know, interview with him, because it's very personal. And when people kind of are able to open up those personal, the intersection of the theater and, you know, their lives, it's really moving to me and means a lot.
So you've had people make an impact upon you, and I don't know if you can take a breath and understand the impact that you've had on so many other people. You have such a huge following on Twitter and Facebook, and the stories that you write are so, they make such an impact on so many people. One of the people that you made an impact upon was one of Broadway Radio's listeners out of Texas, Alexander J. Alvarez, AJ, who came, works for you at 54. I mean, he like left Texas with nothing but a dream, and he came to work for you. And it just shows that, you know, certainly five, maybe more years or so ago, you know, the 54 Below thing was just an idea, and it, it is such an important part of the Broadway ecosystem now. How has 54 Below changed in the and is it, you know, it seems like you've made this idea a vital part of Broadway, in not only an outlet for some excellent entertainment, but a way in which to get people in the door in the theater district to see things that we wouldn't have seen before.
Totally. And thank you for saying that. That means a lot coming from you. You know, it's when I started 3 years ago and the place had only really been open for a year, I really did want to make it, you know, I wanted to do musicals and concert. That hadn't really been done yet. In that way, like new musicals and underappreciated musicals of the past. And a lot of our programming I refer to kind of as history live, because you get to see a lot of like reunions and a lot of people coming back together to perform material they did that you might not have seen. And, you know, we do a lot of, you know, supporting writers by, you know, having them give a stage to do songs they just wrote or songs that, you know, you haven't heard, emerging writers, established writers. And then, you know, a large part of it is also wanting, you know, those actors that have never done a solo show to do one, and wanting those legendary actors that, you know, have that experience to do something new. So we just kind of, you know, my goal is to like embrace all corners of the Broadway community, like all ages and every kind of music. So a lot of the programming is just going like, okay, like what is, you know, the Broadway community? And then like, how do you give people a backstage pass to kind of hear and see from, you know, all those people? And, you know, it's really exciting when we have fans there who, you know, I experienced this recently during Adam Pascal and Anthony Rapp's duo shows, who were just like, this is the best night of my life. Like, this is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. And you go like, oh, like, you know, I said to Anthony and Adam a few times, like, you're putting such joy in the world. Like, everyone walks out of this place and they're like, that is something I waited 20 years for, or like, you know, I'm so happy. And you carry that into the universe. So I think that's somehow how, like, you know, concerts that are done in a basement can really make a difference in people's lives by giving them that level of joy. It was very nice to see that. But really, I mean, it's so exciting to have a room that seats 150 so that, you know, and there's less pressure than when you're obviously producing a show, even on any level, because, you know, you can do one performance and you can kind of do it in a scrappy way, but still let people see your work. And a lot of like collaborations between writers and actors have started because of something at 54 Below. And a lot of people have kind of gotten their first exposure to cabaret, both on the audience and on stage. So, you know, really, like, I love that there's 16 shows a week. Like, it is so much work, but it provides this like revolving door of like new talent and established talent, all interacting together. It just gives you like a large canvas on which to paint lots of shows. So there's, you know, there's always really exciting stuff coming up. And right now we're kind of booked through May, which is crazy. That was one of my goals when I started, was help everybody to, you know, do better with their shows by having them announced so far in advance. So, you know, of course there's definitely shows to fill in earlier months, but really you look at the May calendar and I'm like, oh my God, we have like six shows already on the schedule for them. So yeah, it's a really exciting place, and I love that it's like become Broadway's living room. Like, that was the dream for it, and it feels like it's really become that.
So the energy that I feel in 54 Below, I only felt in one other place, which was Broadway Con. So you sort of have a Broadway Con happening 365 days a year there, which is awesome. and is it true that one of the hardest tickets to get is Joe Iconis at 54 Below?
You know, yes, and that's always been like a delight. I mean, certainly not if you buy your tickets early enough, but we do these shows there, and that's actually how I got my job, was that, you know, I produced some of Joe's stuff at 54 Below, and when they were looking for a new programming director, they said, oh, we should talk to that girl. We like, you know, we liked what she did on those shows. So thanks, Joe, really. But yeah, you know, there's so much excitement around whenever he does something there, that, you know, is something we've cultivated over the past like 9 years. So, you know, what he does is so unique in that obviously he's like writing new musicals, but he also has such a deep appreciation for, creating like a unique cabaret that is like filled with, you know, songs that you can hear in that context, and, really like, you know, a family of very talented performers. And those are always so exciting. We have our 9th annual Christmas show coming up in December, which will be really fun.
The 9th annual, but 54 Below has only been open a number of years. So so where did it happen?
Yeah, we actually did them at Ars Nova for the first few years. And then we moved to 54 Below when, and this is actually, you know, this is all part of it. We loved doing it at Ars Nova, and they had a show 1 year, so we couldn't do it there, and we had to do it at another venue. And so we did it at 54 Below, and that was part of what, you know, helped me get my job, was that they loved, you know, how we did it there that year, and we've done it there ever since.
So before we started recording, we were chatting a bit about Ars Nova, and I think you said something really, really important for everybody to hear. So why don't you repeat that about Ars Nova and with regard to the current ongoings between Ars Nova and the production of Great Comet?
Yeah, you know, I love Ars Nova, and I feel like the outcry of support from the theater community has been so like moving, and I love, you know, everyone hashtagging I'm with Ars, and I certainly am, and I think they should get that credit that they deserve. And I think, you know, I haven't talked to anyone in the theater community that doesn't feel that way, but maybe they're just not piping up. But I also think that when these things happen in like the theater world, people are very quick to kind of give these detailed opinions of, you know, a diatribe about what this all means. And I kind of always go, you probably don't know the full story. And what we know is from like one New York Post article. And what I know is that they should get that credit, but I don't know the details of this. And there was something that happened last, you know, the same week that this happened, like, you know, a week and a half ago, where everyone was kind of screaming about that Roundabout Lounge, and how, you know, Michael Kors donated all this money and it was going to a lounge instead of to, you know, shows. And it wasn't even true. It was that he had donated all this money so that, you know, for everything that the theater does. And then they were just naming this lounge after him because of the donation. And, you know, everyone was screaming about it. And I just always kind of look at that and I'm like, you know, when something like that happens, you want more than one source, or you want 24 hours to pass, or you want to talk to someone who's actually working on it. Because I know from being part of organizations and shows that have had those kinds of things happen, like, usually the public doesn't know the full story. And again, like in this situation, I'm not saying anything that Ars Nova deserves, you know, obviously this credit, like 100%, but we probably don't know some of the stuff going on behind the scenes. And I saw a lot of posts where people were like, I love Ars Nova and I support Ars Nova, but go see Great Comet anyway, because it's a great show. And it's like, those people aren't reading that Ars Nova is not telling you not to see Great Comet. Yeah. Those people are thinking that this is like a war between the two. And it's just that kind of thing that you're like, okay, everyone, take a step back, wait for like a statement from Jason Egan. That'll tell you what actually is like going on. And don't like jump to weird detailed conclusions. Like, show your support. They should get the credit, but like, you don't know the exact situation. So that kind of thing always is like a pet peeve of mine. And I think from like just chronicling history, you see all these times where people didn't know what was actually going on. And I think that's just something that like I'm more aware of now.
In this case, that statement did eventually come from Jason and the Ars Nova administration. So, but I absolutely agree with you about the rush to judgment. On the other hand, I guess it's human nature. We read, and it certainly happened, as we mentioned before we started recording, just in the past few days with the most recent quote unquote Hillary Clinton email quote unquote scandal, that I can't tell you how different the reports were in various outlets within the first few hours, and then there was, you know, some backtracking, and then so yes, your point is very, very well taken.
So let's leave on a note. Let's leave on a fun note here. We are recording on Sunday morning, October 30th, 2016. Jennifer Ashley Tepper, what are you going to be for Halloween?
Oh my gosh. You know, I had to dress up in a Halloween costume the other night, which for Halloween. So I pulled out Elaine Stitch, which was really fun because I was at like a get together at the Players Club and Alice Ripley was there. So I have a picture of like Alice Ripley and Elaine Stitch, like two legends, although I'm not actually Elaine Stitch. It was very funny. But for actual Halloween, and this ties it all together again, for actual Halloween, I'm being Chelsea Clinton.
Oh, I could see that. Absolutely. And yeah. I guess we'll see pictures of that at Twitter at Jen Ash Chap.
Hopefully I'll do a decent job of conjuring that. What are you guys being for Halloween?
I'm going to be a dad taking his kids around to get candy. And I'm going to eat. I have to test. I'm the candy tester. So I can do test all their candy. I'll eat all the candy before them. But has your Broadway career affected your family? Are your parents dressing up for Halloween?
Oh, that's so funny. So obviously, you know, before we started this, like 30 seconds before you called, my dad texted me that he's going as Aaron Burr for Halloween. And the funny other part of this is he's going to a Hamilton party that like adult doctors, because he's a doctor in Florida, are putting together. So not only like, you know, has Hamilton like infiltrated the world, but it's like my dad's Halloween party that he's going to. It's very funny.
I have to share. I'm not planning to dress up, but a friend of mine, Tyler Milliron, who's a wonderful actor and producer, he posted a photo of himself with all these bruises on his face and on Facebook. And the tagline is, he says, this year I am going as, quote, your bruised ego after leaving comfort and moving to a big city in pursuit of your dreams.
That's amazing.
I thought that was very creative.
Very clever.
So Jennifer Ashley Tepper is the programming director at 54 Below, the author of Untold Stories of Broadway Books, volume 3 coming out. When's the release date of the third volume?
November 15th, so very soon.
And I hear it fits very well into a stocking. So she's also a theater historian, a producer, a writer, a dreamer, and a doer. Jennifer, thank you so much for coming on again to Broadway Radio and talking with us. We always love to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always so fun. I just feel like we're all talking, and you know, it's very like exciting to talk to my fellow like theater aficionados.
Oh, that's very kind. You have a great Sunday, and we'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
How are you doing? Bye.
Bye.
Okay, we're going to do something a little bit different that we don't normally do. We have a little bit of a theme today that, Michael, you saw a bunch of things that made you cry. So
yes.
Let's start off with Sunday in the Park with George. That made you cry?
Yes, tears of joy and rapture. I mean, sometimes, not too often, I go to the theater and I want to cry because things are so awful. But that's relatively rare, I'm happy to say. And this wasn't planned this week, although in retrospect, I look back and I probably should have guessed that I would be – that I would have tears in my eyes at several of the events I intended because just tears of joy and very moving things that – happened, the pieces themselves, the people involved with them. One of them was Sunday in the Park with George at City Center. It was a benefit for Encores, and it was originally planned to be one performance, but Jake Gyllenhaal was playing the role of George, and I think partly for that reason it became extremely popular, and they added performances, and they wound up doing a total of four performances over 2 or 3 days. And I got to go through the generosity of a friend of mine, David Hurst, who invited me to the final performance. And it was not a perfect production, but it was definitely good enough that the most beautiful portions of the show came through. The show itself, it's not one of my absolute favorites. I think it does have some pretty big flaws, mostly in terms of the book by James Lapine. But there are several moments in the score that are so transcendent, including the song Sunday, the finale of the first act, where we see the painting that George Seurat created so beautifully come together on stage. That has always been, I think, one of the iconic moments in musical theater ever since the original production. And it never fails to move an audience between the beauty of the music and the lyrics and the staging, just seeing that incredible painting come together. And then also in the second act, there's a song called Move On that it's just so inspiring to an artist, anyone who has any kind of artistic aspirations. And there are several other moments in it too, that just really move you to another plane of, oh my God, what musical theater can do when it's at its best. There are several moments of that in Sunday in the Park with George. I was not surprised that Jake Gyllenhaal did such a wonderful job. He has had fairly limited stage experience and also in New York City, but I've been lucky to see him in all of the things that he's done, including Little Shop of Horrors, as part of the Off Center series and Encores, I guess, last year, and in which he was also fantastic. So I was not surprised. He was not perfectly cast in Sunday in the Park with George, but he sang so beautifully, and he is a really wonderful actor, and he got the lyrics really communicated what was going on in the show. And his vis-a-vis was Anna Lee Ashford as Dot. And I have to say, she is one of the most talented newer discoveries in both musical and non-musical theater. Just a pretty perfect performance from her. The whole cast was the bench, as they might say, was amazing for this show. People in minor roles, like Brooks Schmanskas, Philip Boykin, Carmen Cusack, Gabriel Ebert, Claiborne Elder, Jordan Gelber, Lisa Howard, Zachary Levi, Liz McCartney, Ruthie Ann Miles, Solis Pfeiffer, Gabriella Pizzolo, Felicia Rashad, Lauren Worsham, Max Chernin, Michael McElroy, Stephanie Lee Park, and Jamie Rosenstein. That's the entire cast I just read. So that was an incredible tear-inducing evening in the theater. And then I saw a play called A Life by Adam Bach that stars David Hyde Pierce, and it's at Playwrights Horizons. And
unfortunately cannot tell you very much about this play because almost everything I would say would be a spoiler. But suffice to say that David Hyde Pierce plays a modern day gay man living in New York City. And he leads, I guess, a sort of a typical life of someone who's connected with his friends through social media and the phone and things like that, but also experiences feelings of solitude and aloneness sometimes. And this play, directed by Anne Kaufman, is extraordinary in several respects and has content about this person's life that really moved me to tears on more than one occasion. So that was the second one. I'm not doing these in order, but this was my week, folks. It was really incredible. On Sunday the 23rd, I was lucky enough to go down to the National Arts Club, where the Encompass New Opera Theater saluted and tributed Stephen Flaherty and Lynn Ahrens and Terrence McNally, who have done great work in musical theater and non-musical theater, both together and separately. And this, they always do incredible shows, tributes at the Compass New Opera Theater. They do one every year around this time. Previous honorees have included Sheldon Harnick, Charles Strauss, and Barbara Cook. And they're always singular events because, I mean, there are many events in this city that involve people like that, but this is such an intimate situation. It's a beautiful space. It's quite small, and you really get the opportunity to talk to everyone, including the artists who perform, who on this occasion included Christy Altomare, Maria Nello, Liz Calloway, Oswaldo Iraeta, Aaron Kim, Doug Jabara, Derek Klena, La Chance, Michael Marcotte, Adelaide Mestre, Brian Stokes Mitchell, Christian Knoll, James Snyder, and Karen Ziemba. And plus, on top of that, we had recollections and tributes by Tyne Daly, Sheldon Harnick, and Nathan Lane. And also someone who was not in the program, and that someone who was not in the program was Zoe Caldwell. The legendary Zoe Caldwell, who was there primarily for her association with Terrence McNally in Masterclass, in which he played Maria Callas, but all, you know, one of the storied great legendary careers of the theater. She is quite elderly and not in the greatest of health. She, I believe, does extremely limited public appearances, but she did show up to tribute Terrence McNally, and she spoke beautifully. She had to be helped to the stage, and she looked fairly frail. But once she started talking, that incredible voice came through, and the years fell away. And it was another of my weeping moments this week. So that was that event. And then just last night, Saturday the 29th, I was thrilled to be at Carnegie Hall for Kelly O'Hara's solo concert debut there, which she made a big point in the program and in speaking from the stage in saying, never go solo, meaning that, of course, it's not solo, and pointing out her wonderful 12-piece orchestra and her musical director and the people who helped her get where she is. And then also mentioning until they came on stage as total surprises to the audience, the guest stars for the evening, which, are you ready, were Barbara Cook.
Ooh.
Who, I mean, it was amazing. Kelly sang Make Your Garden Grow from Candide. And as the, you know, she hit those incredible, amazing high notes at the end. And during the little orchestral postlude, she said, "Ladies and gentlemen, Barbara Cook."
And Barbara Cook came on in a wheelchair, and they talked, and then Barbara Cook sang a little song that of some show. It was a song written by Vernon Duke, apparently from some musical that I'm not sure if it ever even happened, but she had auditioned for it or was involved in it many, many, many decades ago. So that was an amazing amazing moment. And then later on in the program, Kelly was talking about her Oklahoma roots and blah, 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 blah. And she said, ladies and gentlemen, Kristen Chenoweth. Kristen Chenoweth came out. Yeah. And the two of them sang Oklahoma because they're both from Oklahoma. It was amazing. The audience was levitating. I thought the roof of Carnegie Hall was going to, you know, go blasting up and end up on the moon somewhere. And then aside from that, as I said, the orchestra was just gorgeous. It was mostly strings, and it sounded like a full orchestra, just beautifully done. Kelly's amazing program included some of the most beautiful songs I've ever heard. In addition to Make Our Garden Grow, she sang the title song from The Light in the Piazza, which, of course, she created that role on Broadway. She sang I Wish It So from Juno, which is maybe not the most famous musical theater song, but among the most beautiful. This Nearly Was Mine from South Pacific, in which, of course, she played Nellie Forbush, but this is Emile's song. And her encores were Make Someone Happy in tribute to Betty Comden and Adolph Green and Julie Stein. I Could Have Danced All Night, which I was lucky enough to see Kelly do Eliza in the New York Philharmonic concerts with Kelsey Grammer some years ago. And then she brought on as the very last thing a whole about 25 people from the audience, including her husband, Greg Norton, and her father-in-law, James Norton, who had come on earlier in the show to help her and do a few numbers with her. And they come on, other fellow cast members, babysitters, support system, friends, family, and they all did with a little help from my friends. So that was the finale. And there were several moments during that show that I teared up. So that was my week. And one of my thank God I live where I live and I'm able to see these incredible artists performing this deathless material that just is enough to move you to tears.
Wow. That is quite a week that you had there.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sorry to throw all that at once, but it just, I mean, it was every other day I was, you know, I had the tissues out. I just was
drink a lot really of liquids, restore the tear ducts, restore yeah the tear ducts of your friends.
Amazing. An amazing week, really.
So Jenna, you, your plate, is a little bit full too. We're going to talk a little bit about the Hamilton doc, about Tick, Tick, Boom, about Plenty, and Rocky Horror on Fox. Were these things that made you cry as well?
Not so much. There were not that many tears. I cried a little bit at the Rocky Horror presentation, but not for the same reasons. That was a totally different.
It was common. It was a common thing I heard.
Yes. Did you see it?
I have not sat. I have it recorded. I was going to sit down and watch it later on today. But, you know, I've been pushing it back since it got such lukewarm to bad reviews. I really haven't made it a priority to see. So what did you think?
I missed it also. And the primary thing I'm hearing, tell us if you agree, is that it wasn't quote unquote bad, but just very bland and sanitized.
That's it. Exactly. It's like, when rock and roll first came in, it was boundary pushing. But then by the late 60s, it was widely accepted. By the 70s, punk came in. In the 80s, it really blew up and became hot. You've got all these eras where rock music was, you know, the gritty, boundary pushing style of music. But then it becomes sanitized and acceptable and popular. And I think that's sort of what happened to Rocky Horror, that it became a little bit mainstream, and Fox tried to make it to mainstream. They sanitized it. They cleaned it up. Everything that was gritty about the original Broadway production in the 70s, the original movie of the 70s, it's all become sanitized and shiny and clean. It was very brightly lit. There was no darkness. There were no shadows. And all the low-budget camp of the original film, it was gone. It was almost like they were mocking it. Mm. And it just felt so washed out and bland and family-friendly that, you know, it's hard to shout out the usual responses, you know, all the delightfully dirty lines that we're all used to yelling at the screen. You can't yell these things at these. None of that was there. It was just too clean, and that took a lot of the fun away from the piece, I thought. And, you know, not to insult the actors or the people involved, they did quite a nice job, I thought. And I thought Adam Lambert did a wonderful job, especially as Eddie. I didn't think he could be, you know, he seemed to be the grittiest of the bunch. But when Adam Lambert is the grittiest of the bunch, that's kind of an issue, isn't it? Laverne Cox, she clearly had a lot of fun with the part. But again, that wonderful campiness that Tim Curry brought to the role, that smarminess, again, that's all gone. She looked beautiful. She danced. She strutted. But I don't think that's what Frankenfurter really is meant to be. Frankenfurter is meant to be gritty and dark and delightfully creepy. And that delightfully creepy sense wasn't there.
Well, I haven't, as I say, I haven't seen it yet, but it strikes me as so fascinating because in a way, one might think that having an actual transsexual as opposed to a transvestite in that role, it might sound more edgy or more progressive, but it's really not the same thing. I don't think so. I think that they wanted to be very careful about the way that the character was treated now that it was being played by a transsexual rather than a transvestite. I don't think that the element of, if I may say, gender fuck, I don't think it's there in the same way, if it's there at all.
Absolutely not.
And so although that might have sounded like a really great idea to someone, And I could understand why it would, I think maybe that was a big mistake.
I agree it was. And specifically, there's nothing in the script that suggests that Frank is transgendered. Frank is presented as a woman. All the pronouns are changed to she. Mm-hmm. So she's not a transvestite. There's nothing to indicate that she's even transsexual. She's the mad scientist. But again, that gender fluidity, gender fuck, as it were, is missing. She's a campy woman. And so that menacing sense of Tim Curry in the ripped fishnets and exactly the frayed bustier, all of that is gone. And now we've got a beautiful woman in an elegant, lovely red gown, red corset, but the stockings are not ripped. There's nothing frayed. And that sense of danger, that darkness, this is just a beautiful woman strutting her stuff. There's no danger there.
Right. And I think even the fact that she did look so beautiful as opposed to, I would not exactly say that Tim Curry looks beautiful in the movie and is not meant to. So even that makes it a very different character.
Exactly. When Janet first sees Frank, as per the script, she screams because she's so startled. There is no reason for Janet to scream when she sees this gorgeous woman suddenly appear in front of her.
Right, right.
And where's the danger? There's nothing menacing there.
Yeah.
And I think that's where they really went wrong with the piece. They took away that sense of danger.
So that's been a common thread with all the reviewers is that it's a higher budget, it's slick, and it loses the sort of the heart of what Rocky Horror was and changes the story a bit. So
I also think it would be extremely difficult to do a successful
movie remake of it. I thought when they announced it for TV that it might work, that it might have more of a live feel to it, but this was completely pre-taped.
Exactly.
And apparently with the acolytes were actors, not real people in an audience shouting things, which, you know, and it's not easy to do that, but I think that's so essential to the experience. And I have to say that I do think that they were able to capture it in the Broadway revival. I love that show. I know it was.
Oh, so did I.
I know it was not financially successful, but that had nothing to do with the quality, in my opinion. It just, you know,
exactly.
Logistics. And I think that nowadays it would be much easier to have a successful Rocky Horror on live on stage than on TV or in a film.
Agreed. Absolutely. There was one beautiful moment, though, in the Fox broadcast. Tim Curry played the criminologist, and obviously he's had a lot of medical problems over the last few years, so it was lovely to see him on screen again and performing with the acolytes in the audience, or the fans who occasionally would appear and shout out some of the famous callbacks. When Tim Curry appeared on screen, all of the acolytes stood up and gave him a cheering standing ovation.
Oh. So there was a teary moment in
there was that teary
a,
moment
a good
that
teary
was lovely.
Moment in Rocky Horror.
Tim Curry always deserves a standing ovation, and that was a truly beautiful moment that they added to show true respect to the man. When he first played the part, he had no idea the show would become what it became, and he was pushing boundaries. He was doing things that had not been done. He took huge risks when he first played that role, and it paid off in spades. And I'm very glad for that. And I'm glad they showed him the respect he deserved in giving him a pre-taped standing ovation.
So another show that took huge risks, but in retrospect, it doesn't seem like such a risk. So Hamilton had the documentary, and Jenny, you saw that as well. What did you think of the documentary?
Oh, I thought it was wonderful. They did such a lovely job of explaining both the history of Alexander Hamilton and then explaining the genesis of the musical with interviews with so many people you would not expect to have insights to this, to the overall story. The Bush family appears, Laura, George W., they're interviewed about their insights into American history, American politics. And it really goes in deep. Stephen Sondheim is interviewed by Lin-Manuel with John Weidman, and they talk about how do you bring American history to the stage. They discuss assassins and that musical's influence over Hamilton. And
we discussed it a little bit last week, and there it was so well put together. I mean, they obviously spent a lot of time and effort on it. It wasn't just a lot of B-roll, you know. Not by any means. The talking heads and the way they went to some of the actual historical sites and sat down and, you know, at the desks, and that was, it was really kind of amazing.
Oh, that was wonderful. Not to say that the B-roll wasn't terrific. I mean, shout out to Jonathan Frank and his wonderful camera work. But it was great just to hear the story that they were filming this while he was writing it, and that there were interviews with him in the rooms where it happened. And how wonderful is that to get to see a musical develop as it was being written?
Well, you know, I'm just thinking now, we're talking obviously earlier with Jen Tepper about the Merrily We Roll Along documentary. And it turned out that there was a lot of film done during the rehearsal process of the original production, assuming, I believe, that there was going to be a big hit. It was the new Sondheim show, and after a string of successes. And of course, in that case, initially, it turned out very, very differently from what they expected. So I guess it's kind of the opposite here with Hamilton. They had high hopes, and they prepared, and they did all that filming before they knew it would be a hit. And in this case, it happened beyond anyone's wildest dreams.
Absolutely. But isn't that a wonderful idea, though, that now we have everyone is carrying video cameras with them all the time? And how wonderful would it be if people just took little made little videos of these pieces of art as they were created. You never know when that video will suddenly become hugely important. Imagine if people had smartphones when Merrily was being created and brought to the stage.
Oh my. Yeah.
Wouldn't that have been amazing? Just to get a quick, a 2-minute Vine, or, well, I guess Vines were 6 seconds, but in any case, to get a quick two-minute video with Lonnie Price as he's first learning to sing Franklin Shepherd, Inc.
No, but what I'm saying is that apparently, I mean, it wasn't cell phone video, but there
is. Oh, no, of course not.
As it turns out, there. I think Jen mentioned it was, did she say ABC TV?
I wasn't sure who it was.
But I saw. I haven't seen the film. The best worst thing that ever could have happened, which I don't like the title, but anyway. But I did see the trailer, and there's footage in a rehearsal studio of, you know, Jason Alexander and Jim Walton looking like they're 17 because they probably were only like 2 years older than that. And it's amazing. It's you know, it's professional footage, and it's. I think Jen alluded to that was part of her job to try to find that footage, and it wasn't easy, because when the show turned out to be a huge financial flop that ran for 2 weeks, I guess it all went back into the archives. Thank God that they kept it and it wasn't burned or destroyed or in some way.
Yeah, and that very often happens. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
But think about how many other shows have been written and they don't do well initially, but then they become massive successes later. The Crucible, on its first Broadway run in the 50s, flopped. But now it's become this cultural institution. Imagine people having a record of what it was like to bring this incredibly controversial piece to a Broadway stage. And how great would that have been to have that record? I mean, all the stories that we don't have now, and that's playing into the importance of Jennifer Ashley Tepper's role as a historian, preserving these stories. Now that we have easy ways of recording these things, I think it's so important to get them recorded, get them on film, get them just written down.
There are definitely pluses and minuses to the whole internet revolution and cell phones and cell phone videos and all of that, but the plus side is that absolutely we do have so much of that now, and I think that there are so many blogs and podcasts such as this one available that really the more of these stories are being told now than in the past, when the media was so much more limited in terms of the number of outlets, and people didn't have cell phones, et cetera. And so that is a plus, absolutely.
Who lives, who dies, who tells your story?
Exactly.
So sometimes there just isn't the media there to record your story, and you feel like it has to be told, and perhaps this happened with Jonathan Larson with Tick, Tick, Boom, where Jenna and I both got a chance to see Tick, Tick, Boom this week, which is a recounting of Jonathan Larson's beginnings here in New York as he became the author of such life-changing pieces as Rent. So, Jenna, tell us, you know, what'd you think about Tick, Tick, Boom?
I love the show. I got to see it years ago when it was down at the Jane Street Theater. And it was, you know, at that time, everyone knew Rent. But here were all these new songs. And here's the story, a portrait of the artist as a young man. And we know how the story ends, but we're seeing his growth as an artist over the course of 1 week, how he changes, how 1 week can change an artist's life. And I think this revival put on by incredibly young, dedicated team, they capture it quite nicely. Although I will not give quite as full a rave as I think some others have, that I do feel it's missing, again, almost like Rocky Horror, a little bit of that bite that was in the original off-Broadway production. When it was still, the 90s were not that far away. It was 2001. And when the show first opened, 9/11 hadn't happened yet. And this is now very much a period piece about a very specific time when Broadway was really struggling and the arts were really struggling and the artists were struggling in different ways. But I think this very young team does a lovely job of conveying a different sense of how artists struggle today. And they really connect well to that period piece.
For folks who hadn't seen the original Tick, Tick, Boom, but are big fans of Rent, you go to see Tick, Tick, Boom, and you can see, you can draw a lot of lines between how they got from thought to stage. For many of the themes in Rent, I thought played within Tick, Tick, Boom as well and were fleshed out fully in Rent. And
oh, absolutely.
Exactly what you said about the Jane Street. But the thing about the Jane Street is that that was raw and gritty and a raw space on a kind of seedy part of town when it was – right now it's multimillion dollar apartments, but at the time it was a scary neighborhood. But now you go to the Theater Row and the Acorn Theater, which is this beautiful – newly built theater complex, to have Tick, Tick, Boom in there, it sort of takes it takes the story out of its element and the storyline there. But I mean, Nick Blamire, Sierra Renee, George Salazar, just I felt did incredible work up on that stage.
Oh, definitely.
Covering all the different things, all the different roles that they have covered, all the different, you see the use of, you see the use of the voicemail message, which is foreign to us now, you know, you know, screening your phone calls and the appearance of yet again, a Stephen Sondheim, having an impact upon, a young writer once again. I really enjoy Tick, Tick, Boom. And as we mentioned before we started recording, it's been extended again. So it seems like it's finding an audience here of fans that really want to revisit Jonathan Larson and his work. And
Been extended. And Sierra Renee is going to be, I guess she has another commitment. She's going to be replaced by Lily Cooper. So that will be my excuse as if I need one to go back. I didn't mention Tick, Tick, Boom among the shows that made me cry only because I talked about it last week. But that's another one.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, obviously, at the risk of stating the obvious, there's no way to recreate the context of the original production, because it was Rent was still, you know, very much running in its early years of its run. And Jonathan Larson's death was still fairly recent. And it was just, there's no way to describe what it was like to see Raul Esparza and Amy Spanger and Jerry Dixon do that show at that time in that space.
I attended Raul Esparza's final performance down at the Jane Street Theater. And Al Larson, Jonathan's father, was there as well for that day. And
who's the character in the show?
Yes, exactly. And at the stage door, I had just purchased a poster and was getting the cast to sign it. And then Al Larson walks by and I handed the poster to him and asked him to sign it as well. And I couldn't think of anything to say to him. I mean, what do you say to a man who had to bury his 35-year-old son and then watched his son's dreams come true posthumously? I could not think of anything to say. So I held out my hand and shook his hand and said, "You must be so proud of him." And he gave me this very warm smile and said, "Every day I have a new reason to be proud of him."
Oh. Well, you know, I guess I felt a little bit of a special connection at the time, because I was working at Backstage when Jonathan Larson died, and I had to write his obituary Backstage. Here's an odd connection. I actually knew an actor who was in the actual workshop of the show Superbia that they talk about in Tick, Tick, Boom. It's an actual show, actual title of a show that Jonathan Larson was working on. And we get to hear one song from it, Come to Your Senses. But I knew someone who was in it, the workshop, and I got to talk to him about it. And it was a long time ago, but he basically said that it things that they allude to in Tick, Tick, Boom, that one reason,
it hasn't been done is just logistically. It's a science fiction show, and I think it has a huge cast and just technical. Yeah, I mean, it would have to be a huge, huge production, but I wouldn't be surprised if we see Superbia someday.
I hope so.
Given the continued impact of the legacy of Jonathan Larson.
Definitely. And I will say, one of the most moving moments of this Tick, Tick, Boom revival, Nick Blairmeyer is an accomplished pianist himself. He accompanies himself on the song Why at the 11 o'clock number. And it's just a heart-stopping moment. It's just him at a piano singing his heart out. And yes, I got choked up and teared up watching that as well. That is a wonderful moment. And it's as close, I think, as we'll ever get to seeing Jonathan Larson accompany himself on that original rock monologue that he composed as he turned 30.
Well, actually, it's not the closest you'll get, because there is, a considerable amount of video of Jonathan Larson doing the show himself. So you should definitely look that.
I should
have to see that on YouTube.
As soon as I get off the phone.
Yeah,
I think it has been. I'm not sure if it is now. And also, as you may remember, on the original cast recording of Tick, Tick, Boom, there is one cut of Jonathan Larson doing a song that has since been cut from the show. It's called Boho Days, which I think was the original title of Tick, Tick, Boom when he performed it. He's still there. He's still there doing it.
All right. So we'll wrap up the morning with the final review of David Hare's Plenty playing down at the Public. Jenna, tell us what you thought of Plenty.
It's a really impressive piece. It's 2.5 hours of watching a woman disintegrate, to put it in summary. Yes. And yet somehow it manages to be very interesting and perversely funny. The play follows a woman who, during World War II, an English woman, during World War II, she works in France and is assisting the war effort. And then the war ends and she's expected to go back to that, you know, late 40s, early 50s, role of housewife and mother, and the very limited role women had at that time, pre-sexual revolution. And she is, you know, she has all the excitement of wartime and is now offered the banality of peace. And she can't stand it. She had all these opportunities and all these adventures, and she wants it back. She misses that excitement, and peace is not enough for her anymore. And she begins to fall apart and destroy all of the people she comes in contact with as she looks for that excitement and that danger again. Rachel Weisz, Oscar winner Rachel Weisz, does a beautiful job making this character very sympathetic as we watch her fall apart, always looking for the next thrill and in her search, hurting so many other people. Corey Stoll from House of Cards plays her husband. And it would be so easy to make him this, you know, monstrous controlling figure. And he plays the part beautifully as a very supportive, loving husband trying to understand his wife. And he can't understand why he isn't enough for her. And it's a fascinating portrait of, this play was written in the early 80s, I believe, or late 70s. It was produced at the Public originally in the early 80s and became one of their biggest hits. So this was not too far removed from the sexual revolution and that first wave of feminism, but the play covers that period just before that movement. And it would have been fascinating. I wish I could have seen that original production and see how this one stands up to it. The cast is just lovely, and they make the 2.5 hours fly by.
I saw the original with Kate Melligan on Broadway. It was extraordinary. I have not seen this one yet. I hope to, but I was just thinking, you might not think of these two shows together or having anything in common, but I think there's a through line with Merrily We Roll Along in the sense of, of disillusionment. And also Merrily We Roll Along moves, chronologically backwards in time in a linear way. Each scene is earlier in time than the previous one. But
plenty, I believe. Again, I'm going on my memory of the original production. The scenes are it doesn't move directly back in time, but the scenes are not in chronological order, correct?
No, they're not. It jumps around occasionally.
It does, but I very much remember that the last scene is very much equivalent to that rooftop scene in Merrily We Roll.
I had not thought of that.
Yes, you see this young person full of idealism and hope for the future, and having, you know, already seen what this person is subsequently going to go through, and the challenges and disillusionment of life. It's heartbreaking. It really is. Yeah.
And that's where the title comes in, that they were promised a time of plenty, but nothing was enough.
Yes.
And you're right. I never even thought about the optimism and the hope of a time of plenty for the kids on that rooftop comparing to a time of plenty for one woman who just helped in the war effort and is now being dismissed.
Mm.
That's a wonderful connection. Thank you. I hadn't thought of that.
Well, yeah. Like, I mean, I don't think you would normally think of those two shows together, but yeah.
We have to thank Jennifer Ashley Tepper for connecting all these things together for us.
Yes.
All right. So that kind of wraps it up for today. Before Peter remotes in and gives us his trivia answer, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com and subscribe. There's a link that way. Each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us many ways. One of the ways is iHeartRadio has an archive of all of our stuff and plays us every day. Google Play and anywhere else that you can listen to finer podcasts, you can get it there, and as well as the Stitcher app. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Jenna, for Michael, for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. All right, Peter, joining us all the way from Cincinnati. Why don't you give us the trivia answer for last week?
What Tony-winning actress was in a musical in which she played a character with her same first name, but during the show had to pronounce it differently? I'm talking about Barbara Harris, who was in The Apple Tree. And during the second act of The Apple Tree, she played a character who spelled her name the same way, B-A-R-B-A-R-A, but it was pronounced Barbara because she was a barbarian. So that's the answer.
All right.
A new question?
Yeah, please.
With this recent production of The Cherry Orchard, I was reminded of how those three exact words were in a lyric in a musical's 11 o'clock number. It's a show that opened to unanimous raves and is one of the most reviled by musical theater fans. What's the song and what's the musical?
Okay, so if you have an answer to this week's trivia, please email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com and we'll let you know if you're on the right track. So on behalf of Jenna Tessa Fox, Michael Portantier, Peter Felicia, Matt Tamanini, and me, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
In stories I try, that's not what